6 past the hour on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, progressive utopians with no sense of humor. Good morning, all people that don't have to work today in honor of Martin Luther King. Good morning, Mark Riley.
Good morning. Happy King Day to all.
I hope there's some serious reflection going on out there throughout the day, as we will be doing here. We've got some great little pieces of Martin Luther King speaking in many different contexts.
Well, because a lot of what he said back when he was alive is applicable today. But you know what's the irritating thing about today, man?
What's that?
Is that there are going to be all of these preachers, and they know who they are, who will get up and invoke the name of Martin Luther King. A lot of them did it yesterday from the pulpit. And at the same time, they're taking some of that $5 billion worth of faith-based initiative money that this president, whose vice president, by the way, could not find it in his heart to vote for a Martin Luther King holiday when he was in Congress.
Right.
Talk about Cheney.
Right.
Let's be clear.
Yeah.
All of these guys are going to talk about King while they take money from these fools.
Yeah. I'll tell you, you know, listening to a few of those sound bites before we get on the air today, and we'll listen to them throughout the show in a little while, the incredible courage and the true nads of that guy, Martin Luther King, to get up and say what he said, even now, I mean, it almost moved me to tears just to hear the courage of being able to say that. And the country being as divided as it was then, I mean, it's divided now, but nothing that we could even, I can't even imagine what it was like then. And for him to say what he said, oh, my God. I can't even imagine, like, you know, what the cultural momentum against that guy was, you know.
Well, the cultural momentum came from two different sides. When he first started during the Montgomery bus boycott and through the early civil rights movement, the opposition came directly from white racists, okay, whether it was the Klan or, by the way, and this is something that's instructive for those of you who have never read or heard Letter from a Birmingham Jail. That's what's instructive about that, because there were large numbers of clergy people, both black and white at the time, who told him to slow down, to wait, that the kind of street demonstrations and civil disobedience that he espoused, it wasn't time for that yet. There were a lot of people who urged him to go slow. In fact, a group of clergy people wrote him a letter. And that's why he responded with a letter from a Birmingham jail, which is 19 pages long, and was an extraordinary example of King standing firm in the face of opposition from large numbers of people of his own, you know, persuasion, clergy people.
And I would say that in retrospect, they were wrong. I mean, they, you know, he should have done what he did at the time he did it, because if he didn't, there might not be the waiting for negotiations. In these kind of things, the waiting for something simpler or something easier, something more less momentous to evolve, a lot of times just dissipates into nothing, and the same stays. The status quo never gets shifted.
Well, you know, you hit the nail on the head when you said negotiation, because the clergy people said, well, we can negotiate these issues, we can deal with them. You don't need to do the demonstrations in order to negotiate. King's response essentially was, we will negotiate. We have no problem with negotiating, but we're not going to stop demonstrating pending the successful conclusion of the negotiations.
Right.
And, you know, the other thing, Mark, of course, was that he began to receive opposition in the mid-1960s, not long before he was assassinated, from two elements that would have traditionally been his allies. On the one hand, the emerging Black Power movement led by Stokely Carmichael and H. Rapp Brown and others, who thought King's approach was too gradualist and that nonviolence was not going to work. And the other opposition was from people, including many mainstream civil rights leaders at the time, who opposed King getting up and speaking against the war in Vietnam. And we have a piece of sound that we're going to play for people that crystallizes his opposition to the war in Vietnam.
It's an amazing thing that, like, when you hear some of this stuff, that there's a tenor in his voice and there's an immediacy to it and a passion to it and a courage to it that you don't hear anymore. I don't know if I've ever heard it in my lifetime, Riley. I mean, I was born in 1963, and I don't know that if I have ever, you know, bore witness or seen something that intense and that passionate and that courageous live in my life. I don't know. Do you remember anything in the last maybe 40 years of that momentum, of that impact?
Absolutely not. I mean, you have to understand, Dr. King was in many ways a genius. This is a guy who had graduated college at the age of 16.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, he was a young guy. He died at 39. He won the Nobel Prize at 34. He was a man of extraordinary intellect and of education, too, because he was born into what was then the very small black middle class. His father was the pastor of the Ebenezer Baptist Church. His mother was a school teacher.
And he was, like, in the 11-year period between 1957 and 1968, Martin Luther King traveled over 6 million miles and spoke more than 2,500 times. He wrote 5 books and numerous articles.
And his house was bombed, I don't know how many times.
This dude got stuff done, though. I mean, can you imagine that?
Well,
can you imagine
that? It is an extraordinary record of accomplishment. And it was a record of accomplishment by a man who never looked to personally aggrandize. He didn't die a rich man.
Mm-hmm.
He had nothing. He and Malcolm X had that in common. Both were assassinated young. Both were assassinated at a time when they were not bringing in substantial amounts of money from their activism.
Time Man of the Year, 1963?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Winner of the Nobel Peace Prize in 1964.
Unbelievable.
An extraordinary record of achievement. And again, a person who was not dissuaded by failure. He tried to, for example, lead marches in suburban Chicago and was met with all kinds. I mean, was met with fiercer opposition than he met in the South in many instances. I mean, people coming out with axe handles, the whole nine yards, a very vicious strain of racism. He was not successful. He came to New York on many different occasions, including in 1958 when a woman who was later found to be deranged plunged a 7-inch letter opener in his chest. Had to be taken to the hospital, almost died.
It was just a case of a crazy person?
A person who thought that he was, who had listened to the propaganda against him at the time, which included he was a communist. By the way, there are still people who claim that Martin Luther King was a communist, he was an outsider. That was one of the things he spoke to in a letter from a Birmingham jail, because this was obviously Birmingham, Alabama. Martin King was from Atlanta, they're born and raised. So he was seen to some extent as an outsider, even when he was brought in to Montgomery, Alabama.
The Dexter Avenue Church?
Yes, the Dexter Avenue Church. The Dexter Avenue Church was looking for a dynamic, young, black preacher. And Martin King, his fame had spread far and wide from Atlanta at the time, where he was acting as assistant to his father at the Ebenezer Baptist Church, which is the most popular church in Atlanta.
Well, this is great. We're going to hear the sound it's a piece from a speech he gave in talking about loyalty and dissent. And I swear to God, if you replace the word Vietnam with Iraq, your mind's going to blow.
Absolutely.
Right? It's 14 past the hour. We'll be back with that after this on Air America Radio.
Who are these people? Morning Sedition.
On record, it's out. It's no secret anymore.
Morning Sedition from Air America Radio.
Team past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's Martin Luther King Day. Thank you for listening. If you're up and awake and doing that, if you're sleeping, then whatever I'm saying now is going to be lost on you.
Well, maybe not. If they have the music, if they have the radio on, it may just seep into their REM subconscious.
I had some weird things happen in my subconscious because I woke up an hour earlier than I needed to, which is crazy because that means it was like really.
Yeah, I know. I know the feeling.
And I literally thought the clock said something different. And I had all these weird dreams last night about like someone was playing some sort of strange, almost like I don't know if it was. Middle Eastern music or it was Ukrainian, but it had a very unique drum beat and it was a very pressing sort of sound outside, and it somehow integrated itself into my dreams, and I felt like some sort of strange momentum, like something bad was going to happen because of the drumming that was going on.
Wait a minute now, was this a neighbor?
No, I think it was a car in the street, but like it wasn't a 4/4, it wasn't a signature. It was a unique drum beat that you don't really hear in America much,
okay.
You know, because you listen to some, Baltic pop or Indian pop or Pakistani music, the time signatures are completely different.
Yeah,
and in waking consciousness, they were tweaking me out a little bit. Also, I wanted to. I don't even know. You know what I mean? Where you just sort of like, I can't even, I wish I could remember the beat. I'll try to remember. I want to thank a couple of people last week as I was going on my Coinstar tirade, my looking forward to paying money to have a machine count my change so I could turn it into cash, into paper money. Someone wrote me on the internet there, on the email, that Commerce Bank does it for free. Commerce Bank has coin counters for even if you don't have an account at the bank, you can go in and dump your money into the slot and it'll count it for you and for nothing.
Really?
So I went down to Commerce Bank, and it's so wild when you've got all this change. And I literally thought you can guess on the machine how much you're going to get and maybe get, like, a little prize or something. So I thought like, $70.
Wow.
$255 in
really?
Change, in a bag of change. I turned it right into money. It became real money to me. It was all this stuff that I just would put in a jar, and now it's, like, money in my pocket that I can buy things with. I could have bought things the other way, but it would have been complicated because
well, yeah.
it's all change. Wow, this is digressed into nothing. Here we go. Let's try to...
we'll get back to it.
Well, let's get back to Martin Luther King. This is from Reverend King at Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, Georgia, on April 16th, 1967. The thing that amazes me about this, because, you know, I got to be honest with you, before today, never heard it. And apparently during the sermon, this was the only time that he addressed the Vietnam issue.
It's the only time it was recorded. He addressed it more than once, but this was the only time that he was on being recorded. Stating his opposition to the war.
Just a tremendous amount of guts and obviously, you know, a great tenor in his voice. And I swear to you, you know, if you think about this in the context of what this country is going through now and the type of division we have and the type of, you know, even in relation to the voter suppression tactics that are still being used against African-American people today and also this war, I mean, it's devastating. Can we hear it, Chris?
One of the difficulties in speaking out today grows out of the fact that there are those who are seeking to equate dissent with disloyalty. And it's a dark day in our nation when high-level authorities will seek to use every method to silence dissent. But something is happening and people are not going to be silent. The truth must be told. And I say that those who are seeking to make it appear that anyone who opposes the war in Vietnam is a fool or a traitor or an enemy of our soldiers is a person who has taken a stand against the best in our tradition.
You know, it's the oratory effect of that tremolo in his voice.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like he's surfing your brain waves. He's surfing sound waves, and they go right into your head. The tremolo is a very interesting thing. I don't think I've ever heard it before, to the point where before we went on, I said, is that a condition of the recording, or is that actually the way he delivered his message?
No, that is actually the way he delivered his message. And in many instances throughout his life, Mark Maron, Martin Luther King delivered these messages without any notes.
Mm.
No script, no notes. He simply spoke from the head and spoke from the heart. And what a lot of people, what caused people to distance themselves from Martin Luther King at this particular time, which was early 1967. Now, you have to kind of put this in context. Lyndon Johnson had not, at that point, I don't think, announced that he would not seek the presidency in 1968. So he was the person that had spearheaded the Vietnam War, but he was also the person who had passed the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Act of just a few years earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, a lot of black leaders of mainstream civil rights organizations did not want to cross Lyndon Johnson on the war issue. Most specifically, Roy Wilkins, who was then the head of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP. What Martin Luther King saw that Roy Wilkins and them did not see at the time was the potential for merging the civil rights movement with the emerging anti-war movement,
mm-hmm.
and creating, in essence, an integrated peace movement, peace/civil rights movement in the United States, which King felt could not lose.
Right.
Because he knew that there was an emerging, particularly among young white kids who would end up going into the service if they were drafted, because remember, there was a draft then. He knew that there was an emerging opposition to the war among young white kids who were not yet turned on to the civil rights movement. So it was his vision to merge the two. And that's why he spoke out so vociferously, first in Riverside Church on April 4th and again at Ebenezer on April 16th.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that was sort of visionary on his part, but it caused some rift within the within the community. Is that what you're saying?
It caused a rift within the civil rights organizations, not so much in the community.
Mm-hmm.
Black people were no big fans of the Vietnam War, even though the Vietnam War was the period during which. You got to remember that Korea was the first war that was fought with integrated troops.
Mm-hmm.
Truman signed the desegregation order of the armed forces in 1948. So Vietnam was really the second conflict where there were integrated forces fighting the quote enemy unquote.
Well, let's hear this soundbite. This is in relation to the arrogance of the United States. And again, you know, put it into context in today's world, and this is timeless stuff. This is Reverend King in 1967.
It is time for all people of conscience to call upon America to come back home. Come home, America. I call on Washington today. I call on every man and woman of goodwill all over America today to take a stand on this issue. And don't let anybody make you think that God chose America as his divine messianic force to be a sort of policeman of the whole world. God has a way of standing before the nations with judgment, and it seems that I can hear God saying to America, you're too arrogant. If you don't change your ways, I will rise up and break the backbone of your power. And I'll place it in the hands of a nation that doesn't even know my name.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. It's just like the tremolo effect, man, blows me away. It's got a song effect.
Well, yeah, you know, the eerie thing about this is he could have been talking to Bush.
Oh, yeah, that's it.
That's amazing.
It's definitely a timeless tone.
Yeah. Yeah, and we're going to tell you why he sounds like he could be speaking to Bush. By the way, Ramon was like totally enthralled. He wouldn't even come in here during that. He's coming in a minute, though. We got the Palm Pilot, the Liberal Agenda, and more here on Air America Radio.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley, Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Good morning, Cincinnati, Ohio. Welcome to our newest affiliate, 1530 AM WCKY, the revolution of talk radio.
Yeah, yeah.
I hear it's a hell of a signal, too.
Hey.
We're going out all over Ohio right now.
All right.
Sending the words of Martin Luther King all over Ohio where they are desperately needed.
Maybe Kentucky, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, man, Cincinnati's right on the border there.
Right up kissing Kentucky.
Yeah.
Here is thank you for Ramon, who's very moved today.
Yeah,
very
he was.
Emotional.
He said he didn't know that about Martin Luther.
Yeah, yeah, he's a little worked up, and he kind of walked out kind of pensive and droopy a little bit. But I think it's going to turn out to be all right. Here's George W. Bush's Palm Pilot for today, January 17th, 7 a.m. Wake up, vomit, must lose 2.6 pounds to fit into inauguration pants. 8 a.m. How come nobody's at work today? Is it some kind of federal holiday or something? 9 a.m., call Pentagon, discuss secret missions into Iran. Note, tell them when searching for the most dangerous weapons, look for sticker that reads Made in USA. 10 a.m., think up morale booster for overextended troops in Iraq. Toss out their suggestion of go screw myself. 11 a.m., review plans for inaugural ball. Note, deploy secret service between Punch Bowl and my daughters. 1 p.m., comfort families of U.S. soldiers slain in Iraq by assuring them that I will do everything I can to prevent gay people from getting married. It's the last thing that I do. 9 p.m., damn, it was a federal holiday. Call NAACP.
Oh, wow.
So Cy Hirsch does it again.
Yes, he does.
Cy Hirsch cracks it open. I saw him yesterday as I was on the treadmill on CNN talking to a Blitzer, I believe it was. The plans are in. Iran is in the scopes of the neocon death cult's death machine. They have very specific plans. They're going to, the CIA, I guess they're going to make into just a nice office where they just distribute things that they want to hear. And all intelligence, all covert operations, all the bad stuff that the CIA used to do is going to be in-house, right underneath Donald Rumsfeld. Am I right?
This is an amazing story that Cy Hirsch has told. We have heard little bits and pieces of this story from some of the folks that we've talked to who've been over there, Borzu Dereghahi in particular, who's Iranian and who we talked to from Iran.
And we've been speculating early on because of Hirsch, too, in the alignment between Israel and some of the Kurdish soldiers.
Yes.
And this problem, the talk that we had, you and I, is that are they going to do this? Is the United States going to do this under the auspices of the Pentagon, or are they going to let Israel do it?
Yeah. And that, by the way, is brought up in Cy Hirsch's piece as well. But the central part of this piece is that there have already been groups of reconnaissance people who have gone into Iran trying to identify targets for a potential U.S. bombing raid or series of bombing raids. Now, given what America did in Iraq, people have to pay this kind of thing a great deal of attention. Now, the Bush administration, throughout the campaign, Mark, and you and I talked about this, throughout the campaign, and you know, people were trying to figure out why there was such a difference between the Bush actions in Iraq and the rhetoric on Iran, where they said, oh, we're trying diplomacy, we're trying to talk them out of the nuclear thing. And, of course, that's what the European Union has been doing at the same time as well, trying to negotiate with the Iranians for some form of disarmament and some form of verifiable monitoring to make sure they're not out on the black market trying to buy nuclear devices or material.
And in return, Iran would be given the technology to modernize many different elements of their society.
Yeah. Now, the problem with this, and again, something we talked about before, the Iranians see nuclear technology as a national badge of honor. They want to be part of the nuclear club, although they say not for not for developing weapons, but they want to be able to say to their own people, you know what, we are developing this technology and we don't care who doesn't like it.
Right.
Now, the Bush administration, again, according to Cy Hirsch, is moving on the down low to preclude that possibility. What is stunning about this, Mark, is that the same people who have driven us into a ditch in Iraq, and I'm talking about the entire country, are now failing upward once again to say, these are the people that are going to be put in charge. Douglas Feith, Paul Wolfowitz, all these different curves.
Cambone
is still involved. These people now are going to be, at the same time they're sending out this recon stuff, they are taking little by little the intelligence functions of the CIA and shifting them over to defense, where they won't be subject to the same level of oversight because they will be called military, not intelligence operations.
And this is something that the progressive movement, you know, since the 70s, you know, the black ops of the CIA has been one of these, you know, great demonic forces within the world and constantly, you know, involved in El Salvador, involved in Nicaragua, involved all over the world doing covert operations, assassination attempts, assisting in coups. So now what they're doing is basically saying, well, we can solve that problem. We can just do it in-house. And the CIA just becomes this
group of stooges.
A bunch of pawns who will just give us the information we need to justify the operations we want. Now, I guess the primary problem of this is that no one really knows what the hell's going on. We barely know now, but now we're going to know even less, and big operations are going to be underway, and it's going to be difficult. It's already almost impossible to take these guys to task because they disperse blame, and no one is being fired that should be fired. So now it's going to be even worse because just to get the information in of itself is going to be almost impossible.
In the wake of the CIA scandals of the mid-1970s, there was a commission that was put together that was headed by Senator Frank Church, the Church Commission.
Mm-hmm.
They are largely responsible for some of the firewalls between the CIA and other agencies because they wanted to make sure that the CIA did not, at that time, run amok, which a lot of people were very scared of having happen. Part of what they recommended and was implemented was a system of congressional oversight to certain CIA activities. What you very correctly just pointed out is that Rumsfeld and these people don't want the Congress to know anything about what they're getting ready to do or what they're already doing. The way to do that is to take that function away from the CIA, put it in the Defense Department, make it very nebulous, let the Defense Department be the guys who send out the special ops people, the black recon people, however they want to be described. And that way, as Hirsch quotes a couple of people in this article as saying, we're not going to tell Congress anything.
Yeah, I think they're calling them action teams now.
Yeah.
And obviously this has been the plan all along, because when they put the neocon death cult, put in the ambassador assassin, John Negroponte, into Iraq, you know, this was part of the plan. And it seems to me that this has always been part of the plan, that this isn't, they're not flying by the seat of their pants here in this, in terms of what their actual plan was. They may not have had an exit strategy, but this is, they always wanted to bring this in-house.
Yeah.
And that's why they're leaving Rumsfeld in place, and that's why Rumsfeld takes all this heat. He's been tried and tested at taking heat and showing the public that he really doesn't care. And that's exactly what they want.
Yep. And he's also, and see, now this is where international stuff really gets thick. They've involved the Pakistanis in all this.
Yeah.
The Pakistanis have been giving them information and helping them. Now, the Pakistanis aren't doing that out of the goodness of their hearts. They are, in return for their help, they have exacted a promise from the United States that they would not have to turn over the father of the atomic bomb in Pakistan, a gentleman by the name of Khan.
He's the guy that was running basically a nuclear arms black market operation.
Yes.
That goes throughout the Muslim world.
Bombs Are Us.
Was that primarily for money, or is this an ideological cat?
Well, you know, it's hard to tell. I think he is ideological in that, you know, the Pakistanis have had this long-standing beef with the Indians.
Sure.
And that beef has always centered around who's got the nukes, okay?
Yeah.
India does have nuclear technology.
Mm-hmm.
And with the tacit approval of the United States and the agencies of international agencies that will, you know, monitor these things.
Mm-hmm.
There's always been a great deal of fear about the Pakistanis developing the technology, but the Pakistanis are doing so because they're afraid of being bombed by India.
Right, and the fear within of Pakistan having the technology is that Pakistan's government is not really that stable.
Musharraf
is, you know, constantly looking behind him. You know, no one wants to stand too close to him.
And the thing is, people do not want to see these devices fall into the hands of Islamic fundamentalists, of which there are many operating in and around Pakistan. So the Pakistanis have been helping, and the United States has, up till this point, kind of sort of bluffed them off.
Well, let's talk a little more about some of the tactics they want to use. Let's talk about Afghanistan when we come back, because, you know, the thought is that all they're doing up in Afghanistan is looking for bin Laden, where it seems that what they might be doing is planning to do these action team reconnaissance missions into Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll talk about that, and we'll talk a little bit about the president's response to a question that was put to him by, was it the Washington Post?
Washington Post,
about,
man, what
about bin Laden. It's 44 past the hour. We'll be back in a second on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition, on the air and online at morningsedition.com from Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. I will be in Boston, in Somerville, this weekend at Jimmy Tingle's Off-Broadway Theater in Davis Square, Friday and Saturday, the 21st and 22nd. Come on down and, you know, listen to me talk some more. And if you don't get enough of that in the morning, come hear it live. That'll be funnier. All right. So you can go to our tour dates page on morningsedition.com for info and tickets. Also, join the Morning Sedition Book Club. Purchase Sam Lipsight's Homeland by going to morningsedition.com. If you didn't catch him on Friday, very funny. It's a great book. I'm a huge fan of this guy. This is some dark, funny stuff. It is the kind of book where if you have a sort of brooding, self-centered, kind of angry personality and you feel like, you know, life has gotten you down, I would definitely read this book. You can get that at morningsedition.com. That's Sam Lipsight's Homeland. He will be back in the studio January 28th to take your calls and discuss the book. He's a really brilliant wordsmith and just a great writer. Now, we are in it. We are in the middle of talking about Cy Hirsch's piece, which is The Coming Wars. It's going to be in The New Yorker this month. We are talking about Iran, and we are talking about how the Pentagon and the intelligence The military intelligence complex?
The military intelligence complex.
There you go. The military intelligence complex is co-opting what used to be the CIA's job as far as sending out strange small groups of assassins and whatnot to manage the world's problems. And now it's all going to be done in-house in a very non-transparent way with no responsibility to Congress and no reason to ask anybody other than the president's permission. Is that what we're getting at here, Riley?
Yeah, and you know, even beyond that, Mark, with no thought whatsoever to a single lesson learned from Iraq.
The Defense Intelligence Agency.
DIA, yeah. Defense Intelligence Agency. Yeah.
I have to stop not saying things.
No, but I mean, what we have here are a group of people who so believe in their view of the future of another part of the world.
Mm-hmm.
That they are prepared to, I don't want to say waste more American lives, but that's what it's going to end up being in terms of going into a place where they apparently have. Have you seen anything in Cy Hirsch's piece about an end game in all this?
No, there's no end game. The end game, from what they're saying, is to by the time Bush gets out of office, he wants to put a lid on this war on terrorism thing. They really see this entire zone, this entire region, as being the legitimate front of the war on terrorism.
Yeah.
So, you know, the end game is this sort of mythical end to global terrorism.
Mythical. That's the operative phrase. Mythical.
That's what I think, and that's what you think.
Oh, absolutely.
But the interesting thing about the new tactics are is that once again they think that they can just take some tactical shots. You know, apparently, you know, let me quote Hirsch: the administration has been conducting secret reconnaissance missions inside Iran. At least since last summer. And he says, obtaining intelligence and targeting information on known and suspected nuclear chemical missile sites, identifying 3 dozen targets that could be destroyed by precision strikes and commando raids. Pakistan is helping, as we said before. New plans for an Iran war are being made, integrating land routes now available through Afghanistan and Iraq and new bases in Central Asia. Quote, the neocons want to prove that Bush is the anti-terrorism guy who can handle Iran and the nuclear threat against the long-term goal of eliminating the black market for nuclear proliferation. End quote. That's from a former high-level intelligence official. Quote, the civilians in the Pentagon want to go into Iran and destroy as much of the military infrastructure as possible. End quote. That's from a government consultant with close ties to the Pentagon. And this is Hirsch, quote, a government consultant told me that the hawks in the Pentagon in private discussions have been urging a limited attack on Iran, because they believe it could lead to a toppling of the religious leadership. Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz share that belief, end quote. So that's some, those are really powerful words. But as I was saying before I started that, is that if they go on and do this, who's to say that the repercussions won't be an uprising within Iraq or Iran, won't be a congealed now, you know, if there is a schism between the theocrats and the more moderate Muslims within the country, which a lot of the younger people are, who's to say that this type of action will not cause a type of contempt and hatred against America within Iran that doesn't exist right now? Who's to say that we won't get into a sloppy ground war again? It's just this idea of shock and awe and minimal sort of striking that they said they were going to do in Iraq, and look what's happened there.
Well, I mean, remember, as you pointed out months ago, Iraq has become a central recruiting point for terrorism.
Right.
There's nothing to guarantee that special ops against Iran won't produce an identical result. There's no guarantee that Iranians are going to jump up and say the Americans' bombing is the fault of the mullahs who run the country, therefore we're going to overthrow the mullahs. There is a 50-50 chance that people will unite behind the mullahs just the way people you have united around the insurgents inside of Iraq.
Right. In Iraq, you now have former Baathists, you now have jihadists from around the world, and you now have just, you know, pissed off Iraqi civilians who have become part of the effort and have become part of the insurgency because of the American presence there and because of the amount of death that we've rained upon the Iraqi people.
And see, what people don't understand also in all this is that the Iraqis and the Iranians have something in common, the Shiites. They're on both sides of the border.
Well, the big shots are in Iran, actually.
The big shots are in Iran. It is the mullahs that run Iran are Shiites. Does someone think seriously that the Iraqis, even an incoming Iraqi government, which might be predominantly Shia, would just sit back and say, oh, good, nice move invading Iran. You're killing other Shiites.
Yep.
So how do they get to this? How?
So how do you not make more terrorists is exactly the question.
Yep.
And how are some selective teams going to fight against? I mean, basically, you know, when you put these black op teams or these action teams or however you want to look at it, you're fighting on their terms. You're basically creating, you know, assassin teams to fight as terrorists fight. Now, it's going to be just a test of wills over time. Is it a zero-sum game, ultimately? Is this just going to make, you know, the terrorists more efficient in their guerrilla activities by fighting them with essentially, you know, assassins and guerrilla activities?
Listen to what Cy Hirsch quotes from a former high-level intelligence official, okay, because this is where we really are. We're not dealing with a set of National Security Council option papers here. They've already passed that wicket. It's not if we're going to do anything against Iran, they're doing it, unquote.
You know, I can't help but feel powerless in all this, Mark Riley. I mean, here we have this information. Cy Hirsch is a reliable guy, a journalist, one of the few with integrity, who does real research and has the guts to put this stuff out there. You know, he did the Abu Ghraib thing. He did the My Lai thing during Vietnam. I mean, this guy is the real deal. So here we have this information sitting in front of us. We're telling the people of the world the information, the people that don't know it. And what kind of action can we take? You know, that's the big question. Do we write our congressmen? Do we write our senators?
Absolutely.
You know,
both.
Do we rise up? I mean, does there need to be more protests in the streets about this stuff? Because what's happening here is that, you know, the Pentagon is going to be able to do whatever the hell it wants. It always did, but there were some checks and balances, there was some transparency, and not with this administration, but now it's condoned.
He's got political capital and he intends to use it.
Cambone has been condoned. Here we go. Streisand Compound, Liberal Agenda. Here are your marching orders for today. One, in honor of Martin Luther King Day, have a dream that doesn't involve winning the lottery or a coworker in her underwear. Have that dream. Two, Inauguration Week, Liberal Feel-Good Film Festival, Field of Dreams, The Big Chill, All the President's Men, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, The Grapes of Wrath, The Birdcage, Silkwood, Malcolm X, Fahrenheit 9/11, and maybe some tasteful porn. Three, in response to Colin Powell's claim that our troops would be home from Iraq by the end of the year, keep saying, are they home yet? Are they home yet? Are they home yet? Until they finally come home. After last night's performance at the Golden Globes, take Robin Williams off speed dial. He must be stopped! And today's phrase, just drop it in the conversation, wow, Grainer gets 10 years for Abu Ghraib? Good to know a world-class sadistic douchebag gets the same sentence as a kid selling nickel bags in a parking lot. Wake up, sheeple! The game is fixed, man!
In the next hour, we're going to hear some more from the late Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And filmmaker Ken Burns joins us as we continue here on Air America Radio.
Mark Maron, you're listening to Air America Radio at 6 past the hour, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, people who are home from work today and listening. Good morning to you. Good morning, Cincinnati, Ohio. Welcome to our newest affiliate, 1530 AM WCKY, the revolution of talk radio. Good morning to you. Good morning to people in Boston, Massachusetts, where I will be performing this Friday and Saturday, January 21st and 22nd at Jimmy Tingle's Off-Broadway Theater in Davis Square, Somerville, Massachusetts. You can go to morningsedition.com to the tour date section and get info and tickets. Also, while you're at morningsedition.com, join the book club. Purchase Sam Lipsight's Homeland by going to our website, and Sam will be back in the studio on January 28th to take your calls and discuss the book, which is a meditation on aggressive, you know, apathy, self-loathing, disappointment, done in a hysterical way, in a very articulate and literate way. He's a real wordsmith, my buddy Sam.
Yeah.
So, Mark Riley, the inauguration is this week.
God.
And I just want to say, here's a...
You didn't have to remind me, did you?
But dig this, man. All right, there are all these rules, apparently. All right, thousands of performers, marching bands, color guards, pom-pom dancers, handbell ringers, drill teams on horseback, and Civil War reenactors will be bused early in the morning to the Pentagon parking lot across the Potomac in Virginia, while performers disembark and go through metal detectors. Bomb-sniffing dogs will search the buses. Then everybody will get back on the buses for a trip to the National Mall, where they will spend most of the day in heavily guarded warming tents. Participants have been warned that they will not be allowed to leave the tents except to go to portable toilets, accompanied by a security escort.
Why bother? brother.
Here's the killer, though. Other instructions given performance included warning not to look directly at Bush while passing the presidential reviewing stand, not to look to either side, not to make any sudden movements. Don't look in its eyes while it's feeding.
Wait, hold it.
Don't look directly at Bush or he'll burn you.
Hold it.
What?
There's something wrong with that.
There's a lot of things wrong with that.
No. There's something technically, militarily wrong with that.
Uh-huh.
Okay. When these color guards go past the president, they're supposed to do present arms with their flags. In other words, the flags go down in salute of the president.
Yeah.
When you do a present arms like that, you also look to the direction of the person that you're presenting.
Apparently, not this time. You sort of got to kind of glance
go over
to the left. Don't look at it. That's so weird. They got to do this ritual. And they're like, oh, no, I don't want to meet eyes. I don't want to meet eyes. Oh, no, he saw me.
Oh, my
God. I'm burning. All right, let's get back to, it is Martin Luther King Day.
Yes, it is.
This is a great man, and we've been listening to sound bites all morning, before and on the show. You know, and I tell you, I am amazed at how immediate this stuff still is, how powerful it is. I mean, you know, it moves me in my chest to hear the things that he has to say about the war, because, you know, you just put Iraq in for Vietnam, and this stuff is exactly as powerful as it was then, as it is now, I believe. It's powerful now as it was then in a lot of respects. And I am just sad that I never, in my lifetime, I have never witnessed somebody with the courage and charisma of Martin Luther King in terms of what he did. I mean, when I listen to this stuff, Riley, and I haven't been listening to it, you know, all my life, and I have not, you know, really put it into context as an adult, the guts that this guy had, I can't even imagine anyone having that kind of courage today.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Mark, because he was a disciple of Mahatma Gandhi.
Mm.
He studied Gandhi very closely, and in fact, in 1959, it was 11 years after Gandhi was assassinated, he actually went to India and spent time in India, which kind of made things come full circle, because Gandhi's activism was begun not in India, but in South Africa, which most people don't know. Gandhi spent a good deal of time in the 1920s inside South Africa working against white supremacy in South Africa on behalf of both blacks and Indians. So King knew that, and he followed Gandhi, and his approach was very, very Gandhian in terms of civil disobedience and never, ever using violence, which is where he butted heads with the emerging Black Power movement, who didn't have those precise scruples against using violence.
And it's profound to me that, you know, when you listen to him and when you see footage of him, that, you know, although he was the guy, that you there was a certain amount of real selflessness, of real dedication, of a deep type of courage and humility that, you know, you just don't see today.
No. And the other thing is, there was a great deal of organizational unity in making King the guy. He was not the first person that organized the Montgomery bus boycott. He was brought into an existing situation that had been ongoing for a number of years. But a lot of people who were much older than Martin Luther King, including people like the Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth and others, Ralph Abernathy, who had been in the movement for a period of time, deferred to King precisely because of the power that you hear in the man's voice.
Yeah, and just the charisma.
They knew he was the one.
A real leader. Let's hear this piece. This is from Reverend King at Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, Georgia, on April 16, 1967. This sermon is the only recording of King's remarks on the Vietnam War.
Let me say finally that I oppose the war in Vietnam because I love America. I speak out against this war, not in anger, but with anxiety and sorrow in my heart, and above all with a passionate desire to see our beloved country stand as the moral example of the world. I speak out against this war because I'm disappointed with America. And there can be no great disappointment where there is no great love.
You know, I guess it is a little bit coincidental, and I didn't realize that until just now. Obviously, it's not coincidental that Unforgivable Blackness, The Rise and Fall of Jack Johnson, a documentary, is going to be on PBS tonight, and Ken Burns is the creator of that documentary.
Yes.
That there's no coincidence in that being run tonight, but by Ken Burns being on the show today, I didn't really put it all together. But he's going to be on the show after the break. And Ken and Jack Johnson was the first African-American to win the title of heavyweight champion of the world. And what he went through and where we were at culturally then in relation to where even where we were at with Martin Luther King,
mm-hmm.
the profound differences and just, I mean, the protests and the violence in reaction to his celebrity and his skill and his fame.
It was really a bit insane and absurd, America's reaction to Jack Johnson.
I can't wait to talk to Ken Burns about it, and he's going to be here. You know him from his documentary Jazz, Baseball, the Civil War, and he's going to be with us here with me and Mark on Morning Sedition on Air America Radio after this break.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Team past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Morning Sedition. We'll be talking to Ken Burns momentarily about his documentary airing tonight on PBS, Unforgivable Blackness, The Rise and Fall of Jack Johnson. But first, I must share with you my dream from last night. This is bad. I'm outside this enormous casino. I look up at a 200-foot-tall blinking neon sign. Welcome to Geezer's Palace, where your golden years turn green. Under that is a neon cartoon of Bush dressed as a leprechaun with a wad of cash in each hand. I go in and the place is jammed with old people carrying little green velvet bags that say, My Social Security Nest Egg in gold script. And all of them are gambling, craps, pie-gal, blackjack, slots, sports betting, dog races. And there's one I've never seen, something called the Senior Swirly, which is where old people just throw cash into a giant toilet and watch it disappear. I walk past cocktail waitresses carrying glasses of Metamucil to a table at the far wall under a sign that says, All retirement money privatized for your protection. It's Dick Cheney in a top hat and a red beard working the roulette wheel. He's snarling. He said, Hurry up, people. Place your bets. You're not getting any younger. Let's go. Let's go. Next to me is this frail older couple, and they're huddled over their velvet money bag. She says, Yeah, I could really use some medication for this cough, but we're down to 3 coins. He says, I don't eat that much, sweetheart. Here, bet my last 4 coins and my shirt. He takes off his shirt and bets it on Red 29, the year he was born. Cheney barks, no more bets, and drops the ball in the wheel. The couple says, come on, 29, come on, 29. The ball bounces a couple of times and finally settles on 28 black. Oh, I see Cheney not at the pit boss, Bush, who signals these two huge security guys dressed as leprechauns. They pick up the old couple by the elbow and carry them off the floor through a door marked private. I thought I heard their screaming over the ringing of the nickel slots. I look up and Cheney's staring right at me. His eyes are burning red. He says, What are you looking at? Okay, everybody, place your bets. Hurry up, Grandpa. Let's go. Hurry up. Jeez, you people are slow. Place your bets. I woke up and my bed was filled with the Daily Double.
Ken, come back, Ken. Ken, don't leave. Don't leave. It really wasn't a dream, honest.
Oh, boy. Right now, in the studio, a documentary filmmaker known for Jazz, Baseball, the Civil War. His documentary tonight, the two-parter, Unforgivable Blackness, The Rise and Fall of Jack Johnson, is going to be on PBS. Let's talk about Jack Johnson. The first time I became introduced to him was in a Bud Schulberg book about Muhammad Ali. I can't even remember the name of the book, but I was fascinated with him when I first read about him. Can you tell us a bit about his place in the world?
Absolutely. Jack Johnson was the first African-American heavyweight champion of the world. He won the title first in 1908 after many years of pursuing several champions literally around the world, begging for a chance. But in those days of mm-hmm. Jim Crow America, he wasn't given a chance. There was not an unspoken, but just a written rule that African Americans couldn't fight for the highest title. In those days, the heavyweight champion had huge symbolic and metaphoric meaning. And at the time of imperialism by the Western European and American cultures around the world of white man's burden, to have a black man possibly having a chance to win the heavyweight title was too big a risk to take. But in 1908, Jack Johnson was able finally to get a chance that promoter offered the current champion, Tommy Burns, no relation, enough money to fight him in Sydney, Australia on the day after Christmas, Boxing Day, 1908. He just demolished Tommy Burns. The celebrity journalist Jack London, who was a socialist but whose sympathies for the working man did not extend to people of color, was there and said, we have to find somebody, a white hope, who can wipe the golden smile off Jack Johnson's face. Jack Johnson lived his life out loud in an age when African Americans were expected to defer to whites and everything. He wore the finest clothes, drove the fastest cars, hung out, took lovers of both sexes. And so this period came up looking for a great white hope that would finally beat him, and he just took on all comers and beat them. The ex-champion Jim Jeffries, who had retired undefeated, rather than fight Jack Johnson, came out of retirement to fight him. Jack Johnson demolished him, and race riots broke out. The kind of race riots we would not see around the country until Dr. King, whose birthday we celebrate, whose life we celebrate today, would come along. And this was white-on-black violence, whites going into black neighborhoods, furious that their man, Jim Jeffries, had lost. And when our country could not beat Jack Johnson in the ring, they went after him for his personal life.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, now, you didn't mean to say took lovers of both sexes, did you?
Well, yes, I did, and that's exactly what happened.
He was bisexual?
No, both colors.
Exactly. Oh, both races. But when you said both sexes, I said, whoa, hold on.
Yeah, I was right there with you. I was just sort of like, well, that's cool.
It's early in the morning, yeah.
Both sexes, both races.
This guy was both races.
That was something, man, driving the cars. So, now, it's interesting because a lot of this, I think this type of reaction towards black celebrity still exists in some parts of this country.
It is, the echoes of Jack Johnson are almost everywhere. You can see it in Kobe, you can see it in O.J., you can see it in Terrell Owens. Do you think for a moment if the woman who jumped into Terrell Owens' arms had been an African-American woman, there'd been a fuss? Do you think if Kobe's accuser had been African-American, it would be even a story? If O.J.'s ex-wife had been African-American? So we have this, look, Jack Johnson engages all these themes central to America. It's outsized personalities, which we pretend to like. It's about athletic accomplishment. He was the best and the first, and there are those who still believe he was still the greatest of all times. This is about race. Our title is Unforgivable Blackness, after a comment from W.E.B. Du Bois, who said that this was not about character when the country went after him, because other boxers and ballplayers and even statesmen had the kind of off-stage dramas in their personal life that Jack Johnson. It all came down then, he said, to his unforgivable blackness. This is also about sex. This country is almost equally hypocritical about sex as it is about race. And when that sex is between a black man and a white woman, oh, my God, get under the desk until the storm blows over. And in the end, we discovered this was a story about freedom.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. I did not know a lot about Jack Johnson as a kid because my family didn't discuss him that much. You know, everybody was kind of fixated on Joe Louis, who, of course, came along, 20-some-odd years after Jack Johnson?
22 years after Jack Johnson lost the title, Joe Louis won
the title. So, you know, Jack Johnson I learned about as a teenager, and particularly with the emergence of Muhammad Ali. Why were you talk in the film a bit about the similarities between the two men.
Yeah, there's huge similarities, but let's just bring up three. Muhammad Ali fought with a distinctive defensive style. Mm-hmm. The rope-a-dope is the way we sort of distill it today. That's all from Jack Johnson.
Yeah.
Jack Johnson was the pioneer. He'd followed a white guy named Gentleman Jim Corbett. But it was Johnson who had perfected this style. It was much more intelligent, cerebral, elegant, balletic, as opposed to the kind of brawling style that so many boxers adopted.
And he was in jail with a boxer who helped him
as a kid. Really, he had fought around with a guy named Joe Chunsky, and the Texas Rangers had come in and broken up the fight and had taken them both off to jail. And in jail, Chunsky, this old fighter, had taught him the finer points of this defense.
Now, why was he taken to jail?
Well, boxing was a largely illicit enterprise almost everywhere in America, so he was going to do that. Muhammad Ali also had this brash public persona. He didn't invent this out of nothing. And in the dark night of Muhammad Ali's soul, when his own government was against him, he must have taken some comfort from the fact that he was experiencing this in a decade we now consider dedicated to civil rights, whereas 50 years before, Jack Johnson was suffering even worse at the hands of his own government in a decade, I can assure you, was not dedicated to civil rights. In fact, more African Americans were lynched in the first two decades of the 20th century than in any other 20-year period in our entire history.
And even listening to some of these pieces of Martin Luther King speeches, you hear that are so relevant and important today, just at that time, just how much courage, just even, what was it, 40 years ago it took to speak the way he spoke. We're talking to Kevin Burns about his... Ken Burns about Unforgivable Blackness, The Rise and Fall of Jack Johnson. The first part premieres tonight on PBS. It's very interesting stuff. We'll be back with Ken in just a second. It's 27 past the hour, right, Riley?
That's right. You're listening to Air America Radio.
It's time to go.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley, Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Yes, it is.
You're listening to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. Our guest in studio here is Ken Burns. His documentary, Unforgivable Blackness, The Rise and Fall of Jack Johnson, airs tonight, the first of two parts. You know Ken from his documentaries, Jazz, Baseball, The Civil War. We're talking about the life of Jack Johnson. And essentially, his freedom and his, I guess it is a type of courage to live as large as he did at the time he did in as public a way. Do you think some of it had to do with being a role model? What is his legacy in the black world?
It's interesting. He was not a, quote, credit to his race. He was a loose cannon on the deck of the racial politics at the time. Booker T. Washington, incredibly disturbed by him, said a man with muscle minus brains is a useless creature. Even W.E.B. Du Bois, who defended Johnson's stuff, was uncomfortable with his choice of profession and lifestyle. He was a free guy. You know, he came from Galveston, Texas. And Galveston, like New Orleans, was one of those places that was a little bit Jim Crow's grip was a little bit less. It was integrated. It was the coast, got all these influences. Jazz would be created in New Orleans. Jack Johnson was created in Galveston, Texas. But the ultimate question is two things that almost are unanswerable, the failure of biography, filmed or otherwise, is that, two, how did this guy not get killed doing this? And one, how did this kid from Galveston, Texas, have the courage to swim upstream against the current of the universe? And you know what? Our view of this period is the Jim Crow South and the Ku Klux Klan corner. These are the enemies. You know who the enemies are? It's the New York Times and the Daily News and the Detroit News and the Los Angeles Times, who referred to him regularly with the N-word, called him the Dinge, the big Ethiopian, the big smoke. The Los Angeles Times, after he beat Jeffries, printed an editorial that said, "A word to the black man, do not raise your nose too high. Do not puff your chest too much. You are the same lowly creature you always were. Don't get too excited just because somebody of your complexion just won the heavyweight championship." Hmm. The New York Times referred to him as an animal.
Wow.
The New York Times. Oh, yeah. So we are talking about the entire force of the universe arrayed against this man who invokes the most powerful word there is in the face of oppression. No.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to dress the way I want to. You want me to just cross to the other side of the street. I'm going to drive the fastest cars. I'm going to sleep with whoever I want. And in fact, that's his undoing, because when our government can't beat him in the ring, they take the Mann Act, intended to regulate commercial vice, and apply it for the very first time against an individual. Never intended to regulate personal morality, but Jack Johnson's sex life is what they can get him on. And they convict him in a quick trial. He's sentenced to a year and a day in jail. He escapes to exile for several years. When he's finally defeated, overage, undertrained, overweight, the door slams to African Americans, and the next champion that's African-American is going to have to be the anti-Jack Johnson, light-skinned, where Jack Johnson was dark-skinned, agreeing never to celebrate his victories, and Jack Johnson had a winning, big, toothy grin, agreeing never to be photographed with a white woman, never to be photographed in a nightclub. Jack Johnson owned a nightclub. Jack Johnson married white women, and that man was Joe Louis. And it was going to set a stage for what the responsible African-American was going to do. It's epitomized, of course, by Jackie Robinson, who's going to bring the kind of Christian biblical forbearance against all the racial threats and slights and abuse that he would face for the three first years of his major league career. It's only until Muhammad Ali, who's going to reach back across the decades, leapfrog Jackie Robinson and Joe Louis, and find in Jack Johnson the model of a new Negro to go forward as, you know, with a kind of defiance and with great intelligence. You know, the conventional wisdom, the received wisdom, is that Jack Johnson was some animalistic oaf who couldn't contain his appetite.
Oh, absolutely.
The real Jack Johnson was intelligent, articulate, smart, owns three patents with the United States government for the design of wrenches to fix the cars that he liked to drive. I mean, this man is history running on all cylinders of one of those fast cars.
Wow.
You know, when you look at his life and you look at the fact that, he knew going in that his sex life was going to come back to bite him, come back to hurt him. Fired not one, but two managers who urged some caution in how he conducted himself. Yeah,
and
said that he was getting uppity. Why do you think it was that he ignored this? He consciously ignored this. I mean, he said at one point, and I guess maybe this is the best explanation, you know, I do what I do because I'm an American.
Today we celebrate the life of the Reverend Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King didn't get where he got because he was accepting the norms. He swam upstream as well. And I think American history constantly kicks out to us people that are different, people that remind us of our possibilities. You know, during the American Revolution, Bill O'Reilly would have been a Tory siding with King George. You know?
Yeah.
He forgets that if he lived in Iran, he'd be a mullah, right?
Yeah.
But Jack Johnson was willing to see the things as they were. He wasn't going to be a race man in the sense that, Booker T. Washington wanted to, or even W.E.B. Du Bois. He was not just ahead of his time, he was outside of his time. He said, I am going to be who I am. Of course, he was his own worst enemy. That's going to get you into trouble. And we see that kind of bad behavior today as sort of being, you shrug your shoulders and go, yeah, pull down your pants in the end zone. You know, come on. So the hard thing is for us to put our arms completely around all the complexity of Jack Johnson. But in the end, he's a testament to courage, to forbearance, and what bravery really does when you say that powerful word, no.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's funny. If he had been born in 1978 instead of 1878, he would have led a very different life because he'd have been in his mid-20s now. And in 2004, a lot of what he did is not not particularly it's looked at in some quarters, but certainly not by the larger.
Well, you know, he's the original player.
I mean,
if you think about it, if you take him out of his context of his time, he's got the bling bling, he's got the long coats, he's got the fancy suits, he's got the fast cars, the entourage, multiracial entourage, and the fancy cribs, you know?
Yeah.
But the thing is, today, it's a kind of transparent man. What are you risking today with that? Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Jack Johnson risked everything doing that. And that's, to me, what the difference is. And the intersection of race and sex, politics, power, athleticism. This is a beautiful man. I mean, an amazingly modern person. You look at the pictures of him, and he seems almost as if he's been photoshopped into these old photographs, and everybody else with their, you know, tight Victorian collars are there. But Jack Johnson, we know. He's the only person, and I've been doing this for 30 years, who you could pick up and bring into this present time, and he wouldn't have a nervous breakdown the way Thomas Jefferson would. He'd be on.
I'm ready.
He'd be the sexiest man alive. He'd be on Entertainment Tonight. People would be talking about his exploits, good and bad. He'd be a bad boy. But he, at his time, could remind us that, A, not all African Americans think alike. Right? Because the diversity of opinion, black ministers and black newspapers went after him,
mm-hmm.
but a huge mass of ordinary people saw in his example the possibility that they could, that the door had been opened just a little bit, a little bit.
Do you find that with people like Jack Johnson, that, you know, all this, the talk of why, you know, he was able to live like this is that he wasn't asking himself that kind of question. He was like, you know, I've made these decisions. This is my life, and that's it. It wasn't sort of like, should I do this? Should I not do this? He doesn't think I should do this. There's no self-consciousness there.
He's one of these people that you see today without risk. He was saying, look, I think think the best way to handle race prejudice is to pretend if race prejudice didn't exist at all.
And
that's those are his words exactly. And he went on in the face of the New York Times, in the face of the L.A. Times, doing that. I mean, now, 100 years later, we can sort of begin to sort it out and understand this period was terrifying. I mean, it really was. It was
a scary, scary time.
Those lynchings,
to be black in America.
Exactly. Those lynchings happened more often than not because a black man looks sideways at a white woman.
Yeah. Right.
And here, you have a black man who is openly taking white lovers. I mean, it's in the newspapers. The photographs are there. And you think about this, the newspapers went insane.
I got to ask you a question, though. And this is kind of in the context of the total body of your work. Why do you think it was that Jack Johnson, in a book that he wrote that didn't sell particularly well, hold forth against jazz, which you also profile?
Well, this is his autobiography was so self-serving that it was ridiculous. I mean, he told people to eat more fruits and vegetables. He said
that's a good idea.
That women shouldn't go into nightclubs. I mean, that he'd always treat women with respect. That he'd thrown the fight that he'd lost. I mean, it was a self-serving thing, and we tend to ignore it.
It was even later in his career was an apology.
Yeah, much.
27.
He was trying to sort of rehabilitate because he was on the fringes, kept out of the boxing world he loves so much. Look, race in America is there from the beginning. We're founded under this remarkable creed from Thomas Jefferson that says we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Yet he owned more than 200 human beings as he wrote those words, never saw fit in his lifetime to free them, never saw the hypocrisy, never saw the contradiction, and set in motion an American narrative that is both bedeviled but also ennobled by a question of race. And when you get to know Jack Johnson, the complicated hero that he was, and heroes aren't perfect, they're just negotiating their strengths and their weaknesses, the Greeks have told us, you in the end find somebody that carries this story of race along and, I believe, ennobles it in the end.
Wow. Ken Burns, thank you.
Thank you so much,
articulate, very engaging. I can't wait to watch again tonight. Unforgivable Blackness, The Rise and Fall of Jack Johnson, Part 1, premieres tonight on PBS. And thank you for being with us.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. Okay, so now, look, we know things are tough in the job market, so we've decided to help out. We read the news about Bush exploring the Salvador option in Iraq using assassination and kidnapping squads, and then we scanned through the Sunday Help Wanted listings and found this for our morning's edition Monday job listing. Exciting and fun opportunities in death squads. The Bush administration is hiring. That's right. As part of our continuing effort to win the hearts and minds of the Iraqi people, we in the Bush administration are instituting a program of murder and torture, or should we say a more properly organized program of murder and torture. We're creating death squads based on the popular and successful covert killers used in Central America in the heady days of the Ronald Reagan 80s. Successful applicants to these posts will be responsible for intimidating Iraqis not to support the insurgency. You will be giving the Iraqi people an alternative to the rebels, and that alternative is to be kicked to death by you and your new co-workers. Death squads, or action teams as we're calling them, are the perfect place for people who like to kill people but dislike the burdens of a military lifestyle. Who says you have to wake up at 5 a.m. and do push-ups just because you enjoy strangling people with barbed wire? So if your idea of fun is raping an Iraqi grandmother while forcing the whole family to watch, give us a call. But please, no weirdos. Again, Ken Burns, a pleasure. We will be back momentarily with me and you, Mark Riley.
And
we have morning remembrance after this. It's a great day. Again, it was really impressive and exciting to talk to you, Ken.
Thank you.
We'll be back in a minute. Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition, your daily wake-up call to arms on Air America Radio.
Yes, 51 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley on Morning Sedition.
Yo.
It's Air America Radio. That was a great chat with Ken Burns, man.
Sure was.
Dude had the information. What a great project that is. That's on tonight. That is Unforgivable Blackness on PBS. Here we go. Every week, Morning Sedition likes to pay tribute to those recently departed individuals who have changed our world forever, but for the most part remain unrecognized. It is to these unknown heroes that we dedicate this, our morning remembrance with Mort Mortensen.
Oh. Thank you, Mark. Gordon Greenfield, veteran business executive, dies at 89. G.K. Greenfield, whose QTV brand of teleprompters is used by the White House and in thousands of TV newsrooms, died recently in his Florida home while vainly attempting to read the line, "My heart, call the doctor." Don't break down now, boy. Greenfield's teleprompter succeeded in making every president since LBJ appear even more stiff and lifeless than his body surely is now. I'm sorry. Maintain. Greenfield married his wife, Harriet, 59 years ago. After a flop proposal using the untested teleprompter version 1.5 beta, in which he reportedly asked, "Darling, so what's happening in sports?" Who's chopping onions? Is there a kitchen around here? Seriously, guys. What's going on?
You all right?
Yeah, I'm sorry. H. David Dahlquist, inventor of the Bundt cake pan. H. D. Dahlquist, inventor of the now ubiquitous Bundt cake pan, is finally done. At the age of 86, the ailing Dahlquist reportedly died of a collapsed lung after somebody nearby carelessly slammed an oven door. I'm sorry. Doctors attribute his great longevity to preservatives. Dahlquist grew up with a fascination for metallurgy. In 1950, he made his first mass-produced Bundt cake pan out of aluminum, setting the stage for countless delightful desserts and a whole generation of Alzheimer's-induced dementia. Maintain. Dahlquist requested his remains be sifted, combined with two eggs, beaten until light and fluffy, spooned into a greased coffin, and then cremated at 350 degrees for 45 minutes. Yield should be 10 to 16 servings. Do you have a tissue?
Yeah, here you go. Here you go.
Thanks. Oh, just allergies.
Yeah, I know, buddy. You all right?
You know, all right. G.S. Strong, conservative activist, age 98. From 1948 to 1967, D.S. Strong was the noted director of the New England Citizens Crime Commission, a puritanical group battling pornography and gambling. During his tenure, Strong successfully focused the commission's activities against gambling, in turn motivating thousands of out-of-work bookies to force their wives into cheap nudie pictures and prostitution.
God damn allergies!
Doctors say Strong died this week when his neglecting testicles finally receded to the point where they literally crushed his brain. You got a cat in here? My nose is running. Look, I know one of you guys run a cat into the studio.
Oh, man.
You do this to me every time.
You all right?
I swear, you do this to me. I'm all right. I'm not crying. This is allergy.
Yeah, it's rough. You got a rough job. I understand.
Yeah.
Yeah, you going to be okay, man?
Yeah.
So what are you going to be doing today?
I got to sign off, man. This is Morning in Remembrance. Mort Mortensen saying, "Who's chopping onions?"
Man, it's sad, Mort. So what do you do? Just go look at through the obituaries? How does this work?
Yeah, I do that. You know, it's important to, you know, did you learn anything from Ken Burns?
Yeah, I did.
The past is important.
Okay, man.
And I don't want to be like the Bundt cake guy.
Yeah, okay. Well, if you, God forbid, you go, I'll be sure to do your obit.
Okay, thanks. Here, kitty. Where's the cat, man?
There's no cat here, man.
Okay. All righty. Bye-bye. I love you all.
I love you too.
We love you too, man.
Have a good day.
Wow. Cats, onions, everything.
That was rough, man.
Hey.
That was rough. Yeah, I hope he's okay. You going to be all right?
Yeah, I'll be all right.
All right. We'll see you later, Martin.
The Bundt cake pan?
Yeah.
Wow.
That was some heavy stuff, right?
Sure was.
So in the next hour, we're going to have Jeff Jarvis who's going to come on, and then we're going to talk about media stuff. Yeah. I'm still blown away by that that Ken Burns interview. It's like he's a very intense, focused dude, you know, and he's just like he very articulate.
He knows his material. Yeah. I mean, look, he went into a lot of study of Jack Johnson's life. The footage, the film footage of some of his fights, particularly the 1908 fight when he beat Tommy Burns, and then the 1915 fight when he lost to Jess Willard, who I believe was the guy who later lost his title to Jack Dempsey a little further down.
Well, you know, in the posters, and just in that one poster that you see all over the city right now, like Ken was saying, his build was very contemporary. It's very modern, you know. Like you see other cats in pictures from that era, they just walk out, they're kind of lanky and they're not proportioned like that. But the guy is like perfect. It's like he's got this timeless, you know, physique.
Chiseled, buff.
Yeah,
the whole
run,
business. Yeah. So in our next hour, as you mentioned, Jeff Jarvis is coming in. We're going to talk some media matters. We're going to talk more, of course, about the life and legacy of the late Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and much more when we come back here on Air America Radio.
Mark Maron at 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, and hep cats of all kinds. What's going on, daddy-os and sisters? What is the woman companion to daddy-o?
There is none.
From that period in time. What was the jazz phrase for swinging chicks?
Swinging chicks.
Dames. I don't know. There must have been, I know daddy-o. I don't know. You know, I don't know. If you know, give us a call in a minute at 866-303-2270. Right now, we had someone call us on the phone. This woman, Alice. Cousin Alice, as she'll be known from here on as, she is a relative of George W. Bush. It's Alice Graham from Massachusetts. She's a listener of Morning Sedition. We spoke with her on the phone last week. Alice is Bush's 15th cousin, and she's been writing letters to him on a pretty regular basis, and we asked her to read one to us. So here is Cousin Alice's latest correspondence to her cousin George.
Cousin George, how are things going for my favorite war criminal? Actually, you're the only war criminal I'm kin to, unless it's your grandfather who financed Hitler's Luftwaffe factories until finally stopped by what was then a much less corrupt federal government. I'm out here demonstrating, channeling Joan Tilly, our 15th grandmother's persona, pilgrim dress and all. She left children in Henlow, England to endure the horrors of the Mayflower trip, only to die with Granddaddy John Tilly 3 months later. They died bringing freedom to their descendants, you and me. Unfortunately, you are so successful, busy throwing those freedoms away, you don't have any folks around you brave enough to give you some knowledge about the Bill of Rights. Of course, our 15th grandmother's name is not on the Mayflower Compact. Women didn't count back then. That's one sign of progress that we've made. But what change in our shared genetic code? What DNA malformation occurred when Hope Howland, your 13th grandmother, was born? She was the youngest of eight, and by then the DNA mutations had probably made Grandma Elizabeth's eggs weak and inferior. Hannah Howland, Dustrious. Their brother John Howland, Jr., the eldest, begat the line that gave birth to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, which I'm very proud. It is said that Hope, what a misnomer for the ancestress of the destroyer of our republic, was charming but dumb. Today, I have 5 ethical, productive children, one a vet of the invasive wars of slaughter you started. He tells me that his fellow troops from Alabama are well aware of the greed that brought on this war, where Halliburton truck drivers in Iraq make $1,000 a day, and his fellow Army grunts make $27 a day, less if they're injured and have to come home. Your daughters, on the other hand, get drunk on fake IDs and will never see a day of combat. Their appearance at the RNC embarrassed me for the whole family. How about reading the article in the Bill of Rights that talks about habeas corpus, the right of human beings, not just American citizens, to a speedy trial, the right to legal representation, the right not to have illegal search and seizure? Oh, yes, I forget. Because of the obscenely misnamed Patriot Act, search and seizure, even without my knowledge, is now legal. So are the basic foundations of our country perverted. A land of laws is still immoral if the laws favor the rich and bigoted. Please try to live more truthfully, dear sociopathic cousin. Whoops, I forgot. Truth to a sociopath is whatever he thinks up at the moment. Love, Cousin Alice.
How do you like that? We're going to be hearing more from Bush's 15th cousin, Alice, from Massachusetts, as the week progresses towards the inauguration. Right now, I think on the same theme, Riley, it is Martin Luther King's Day. We have been playing some of bits and pieces from Martin Luther King's speech. I want to talk about with you. I'd like to talk about his accomplishments throughout his life. But just trailing, you know, cousin Alice in terms of the sociopathic arrogance of this president and what that personifies within the culture at this time and what he's manifesting in this culture, I think Martin Luther King responded to in his speech at the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, Georgia, on April 16, 1967, addressing the war in Vietnam. This is number two, Chris.
It is time for all people of conscience to call upon America to come back home. Come home, America. I call on Washington today. I call on every man and woman of goodwill all over America today to take a stand on this issue. And don't let anybody make you think that God chose America as his divine messianic force to be a sort of policeman of the whole world. God has a way of standing before the nations with judgment, and it seems that I can hear God saying to America, you are too arrogant. If you don't change your ways, I will rise up and break the backbone of your power, and I'll place it in the hands of a nation that doesn't even know my name.
Amazing. It's just the tenor, the resonance, the message, the impact. I mean, this is 1967, so he's been going at it for about 10 years already. At that point, in between the 11-year period in between 57 and 68, King traveled over 6 million miles, spoke more than 2,500 times, wrote 5 books, many articles. He was polished. He was, on message, and he was, you know, his charisma and his power and the way that he could move people was perfect.
Well, he was also the organizational genius behind the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, mm-hmm. which he co-founded along with a number of other black ministers in the South. And Martin King never changed his message based on what people told him to do. That was true in the letter from Birmingham jail. It was true when Roy Wilkins and other black civil rights leaders tried to argue him out of opposing the war in Vietnam. It was true even when Martin Luther King went on the last crusade of his life, which is when he went to show solidarity with a group of striking sanitation workers in Memphis, Tennessee. It was April 4th, 1968, the day after he spoke to a rally in a church in Memphis that he was killed. That was the day of his famous mountaintop speech.
Mm-hmm. Now let's talk about his legacy and exactly what he did, you know, in terms of his accomplishments. You know, because I didn't know the precise history of Martin Luther King, but he boycotted segregation, obviously, on public buses.
Yeah. Now, that was a situation where an existing group of people in Montgomery had been trying to organize a bus boycott for a number of years without complete success. They turned to the then brand new pastor of the Dexter Baptist Church in Montgomery. That was Martin Luther King, Jr. Mm-hmm. They saw, and we talked about this earlier, they saw very quickly his organizational genius and his genius for oratory. Mm. He managed to do what a lot of other people in Montgomery were not quite able to do at the time, and that was to keep black people off those buses in the face of widespread opposition, not just from regular white people, but the white business establishment, because they saw very clearly the threat that King's boycott opposed.
Sure.
That's why they were talking about not doing, trying to break that boycott. Certainly when he moved on to Birmingham and organized, again, at the request of existing clergy people who had been fighting an existing battle to try and break the back of segregation in Birmingham.
Mm-hmm.
And he was told at one point, and this is in the letter from Birmingham Jail, he was told at one point they were going to remove the whites-only and blacks-only signs from businesses throughout Birmingham. They didn't do it. That's when King decided we're going to keep protesting until we accomplish some concrete goals here. That was when the clergy people came to him and said, well, you're moving a little bit too fast. You need to wait a little bit. And that's what prompted the letter from Birmingham, Jim.
Amazing man. It's 866-303-2270 is our number. If you want to reflect on Martin Luther King today, or you want to reflect about his significance as it is still so present, and so important, the things he said, or just if you want to get something off your own chest, anything you want to talk about. 866-303-2270. It's Martin Luther King Day. It's 15 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Join the morning sedition. Right now, call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning sedition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yo!
This morning's edition on Air America. We got Jeff Jarvis coming up, the editor of BuzzMachine.com, Machine.com. Good morning, Cincinnati, Ohio. Welcome to our newest affiliate, 1530 AM WCKY, the revolution of talk radio. I will be in Boston this weekend, Friday and Saturday, at Jimmy Kimmel's Off-Broadway Theater in Davis Square in Somerville. Go to morningsedition.com for info. Also, join our book club, Sam Lipsight's book, Homeland, very dark, funny, revealing book is available at morningsedition.com. Sam will be back in the studio January 28th to discuss the book and take your calls. Right now, here's the president's Palm Pilot for today. 7 a.m., wake up, vomit, must lose 2.6 pounds to fit into inauguration pants. 8 a.m., how come nobody's at work today? Is it some kind of federal holiday or something? 9 a.m., call Pentagon, discuss secret missions into Iran. Note, tell them when searching for the most dangerous weapons, look for sticker that reads, Made in USA. 10 a.m., think up morale booster for overextended troops in Iraq. Toss out their suggestion of, go screw myself. 11 a.m., review plans for inaugural ball. Note, deploy secret service between Punch Bowl and my daughters. 1 p.m., comfort families of U.S. soldiers slain in Iraq by assuring them that I will prevent gay people from getting married if it's the last thing I do. 9 p.m., damn, it was a federal holiday. Call the NAACP. That's the president's Palm Pilot for today. Let's talk to Annette, and I'm listening to WLIB in Long Island. Good morning, Annette.
Good morning. Hi, Annette.
Hi. Well, Riley, how are you?
All right. How you doing, Annette?
I am great. I'm pleased to speak to a black male that is employed.
Oh, thank you so much.
I want to make a comment, and this goes back to what something that Martin Luther King said. I was watching it, I believe, on Like It Is yesterday morning, and he made a comment about blacks that the unemployment was so high, and this was way back. Unemployment, he said, was so high in the black community that if the whites had to have that kind of unemployment, it would be worse than the depression of the 20s. And imagine that we've not come very far. Yes, there's some black people who have been successful. Yes, absolutely. But I'm talking about the overall majority. Going to the inner cities, when last have you been to Baltimore and seen the kind of a depression-like state? So, to me, what Martin Luther King said then still applies today, not at the same degree, but pretty close to it.
Well, remember, last year there was a survey done by the Community Service Society here in New York, Annette, that said that the black unemployment rate between for men between the ages of 16 and 64 was 50%.
Half.
Wow.
5-0.
That's
so it's not just Baltimore. It's right here in New York as well.
I'm not in Baltimore. I'm in Long Island. But I'm saying when I looked at Baltimore, which is so close to the White House.
Oh, yeah.
That's my point. Mm. It's right under the nose of the White House.
Yeah.
Don't anybody see these things?
Well, you know, the only time black people had full employment in America was during slavery.
Well,
when we worked for nothing.
Of course. You know what? We have got to address those issues. They were never somehow Martin Luther King. I believe had he lived, he would have made such a difference, obviously.
Yeah.
And
that's probably why they killed him.
Obviously. Now, I'm saying we have not addressed those issues because we are still there. We've not addressed them. We've not addressed education. We've not addressed our housing issues. We've not addressed buying from each other. Look at the groups. I'm sorry, guys. I'm getting a little excited.
That's okay.
Okay. Now, look, right now the Hispanics have grown tremendously. Not have they grown in numbers. They've grown in the businesses because they work together. What is happening, Mark Riley?
What's happening is... What's happening with us, and I assume you're talking about black folks
yes,
now.
Yes, I am.
Okay,
let's talk about
us for a minute.
Number
one, we have some people in our community who pay lip service to Dr. King's legacy and little more than lip service to Dr. King's legacy. There are people who are willing to make common cause with folks who have no concern about our issues whatsoever for the almighty dollar. All right, and I'm talking specifically about people who are lining up at the George W. Bush trough for faith-based initiative money. And there are many, and they know who they are, if they're, you know, if they exist in cities where we reach. You know who you are. You know you're going to get up and got up in front of your congregations yesterday and talked about Dr. King and what a wonderful guy he was, and yet you make common cause with people that Martin Luther King had absolutely nothing in common with. Martin Luther King stood for peace. George W. Bush and his entire cabal stands for endless war. You all reconcile that.
Yeah, thanks for your call, Annette, and listening to WLIB in New Jersey. Ken?
Hi, Ken.
Hi, how you doing, fellas?
All right. What do you got, quickly, if you could?
Fantastic show. Just wanted to say one thing. If King were alive today, certainly people can see his connection with Gandhi. My point is that I think you got to go into universities. If Thomas Jefferson said democracy can't survive with an ignorant population, this is what we're moving towards. And I think what happened in Vietnam in the 60s was the real directional change came from youth on campuses. So the question becomes, there was a philosopher by the name of W.E. Du Bois, who is one of the greatest sociologists ever produced in American soil. He said that the function of a university is not simply to teach breadwinning. I don't know if George Bush is listening. Or to, you know, furnish teachers for public schools, but it has to, or a center for polite society. It has to be the center for questioning. Authority.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, Ken, you're absolutely so right about the fact that you can't just, get yourself an education, whether it's high school, college, or whatever, so you can get a job.
Right.
That's what we focus, unfortunately, too much of our emphasis on without, giving any validity at all to the quest for knowledge and the ability to question.
And Martin Luther King went to Morehouse?
Morehouse. Graduated at the age of 16.
So I wonder what, Morehouse is an all-black college?
Historically black college. Not all-black.
Mm-hmm.
Most historically black colleges are no longer all-black in 2004.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, I saw the basketball coach at Florida A&M University is a white guy.
Hmm.
I just saw him the other day. I mean, look, that part has changed. But the bottom line is the mission, the black historically black colleges in this country still to this day produce a disproportionate share of PhDs, of scientists, of mathematicians, etc.
That's great. All right, so here we go. We're going to be back with Jeff Jarvis. Right there, Riley?
Yes, Jeff Jarvis, BuzzMachine.com, y'all.
Talk about the media, and we're going to have... I'm sorry we can't take all your calls, but thanks for calling.
Thanks for calling.
Back in a second on Air America Radio.
Mark Riley, Mornings Edition on Air America Radio.
Day 34 past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yes.
As always, on Mornings Edition here on Air America Radio. In a few moments, we'll be talking to Jeff Jarvis from BuzzMachine.com about what's happening in the... in the media this week, but first I held over one call because this guy fascinates me. It's our little pal who goes by the codename Pollux. What's up, Pollux?
Yeah, okay, Maron. The name is Pollux, okay? You said bollocks.
I didn't say bollocks. That means testicles.
Right? I know damn well what it means.
All right.
Look, I call because once again you're letting the big stories all slip through the cracks.
Uh-huh.
Listen and learn.
Okay.
Have you heard about the robot?
Which robot would that be?
There's more than one?
Yeah.
Oh, man. First things first. Look, scientists in England developed a robot that powers itself by eating flies.
Right.
It's got microbial fuel cells full of bacteria, and the bacteria break down the flies, and then they convert the energy into electricity, and that powers the robot.
Right, okay, yeah, I read about that. It's just experimental. It moves like an inch an hour. I mean, you could probably outrun it.
Very funny. Joke your way around this, Marin.
Okay.
You hear?
Yeah.
I said the robot eats flies. Flies, man! Don't you see what they're up to?
By they, I assume you mean Jeff Goldblum?
What? This is not a game!
All right.
Flies are information retrieval devices.
Okay.
Everywhere they go, they pick up thousands of bits of information on the sticky hairs of their legs. They're nature's spy cams, man, and they can be everywhere. And when the robot eats them, he ingests all that information, man.
Okay, so whoever controls the robot...
Yes.
...has access to all kinds of information...
Yes.
...about dog poop.
What? No, no, no! Here's where the comedy stops and the education of Mark Maron begins.
Okay, okay.
You, look, you grasp the truth by making connections, okay?
Yeah.
At the same time the fly-eating robot is being developed, scientists in Spain discovered that rats have language skills.
Okay.
No, they trained rats to differentiate between Japanese and Dutch just based on the rhythm of the language.
Right.
Only three species have that ability: humans, rats, and tamarin monkeys. See where I'm going with this?
Yeah, I do. So never say something confidential around a tamarin monkey.
I hate you, you know that?
All right. What were we saying?
Look, obviously the language skills of rat story, just the tip of the iceberg.
Okay.
You can bet government scientists are way ahead on this. I mean, it's a short step from telling Japanese and Dutch apart to being able to comprehend every language known to man.
Oh, okay. Wait, now this is beginning to make sense.
It is?
Yeah. Are you saying that government scientists... Are you saying that government scientists have found a way to turn every housefly into an intelligence-gathering drone, and that this limitless information can be retrieved by an insect-devouring automaton, and that linguistically proficient rats are being bred in order to eavesdrop on us, that every floorboard, every tear, and every screen door is a portal to an invasion of our most private space, and that simultaneously government policies cause more poverty and thus spread more information-gathering vermin?
Holy crap!
And as for proof that they're breeding these listening rats, well, 20 years ago, it seemed there were unlimited amounts of free government cheese. But you never hear about that anymore, do you?
Oh, man! I gotta go! There's a fly in here!
Wow.
Hey, I'm willing to make a deal! Who do you work for? Let me have it!
That was Pollux. I guess I hope he'll be okay. Right now, joining us, editor of BuzzMachine.com, former TV critic, and now our media guy, Jeff Jarvis. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning.
Hey,
so,
Jeff.
It's all about rather today. Is that the deal?
Not rats, rather. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So I guess a lot of the four that were fired have put out statements. I have one here, and this is from Mary Mapes. Is that how you pronounce her last name?
Yes.
And she basically said we did nothing wrong.
It's bigger than rather. It's bigger than Mapes. It's really a bigger story about credibility and the news today.
Okay.
Pew just came out with a study that said that only 55% of Americans believe media. That's low. That's a problem. In 1988, Pew said that 58% of Americans thought there was no bias in media. This last election, 38% think there's no bias in media. Now, I actually think bias in media is a good thing. I think, you know, not to stroke the hand that doesn't feed me here at Air America.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But, you know, admitting your perspective, don't call it bias, perspective is a decent thing. But the report that came out after I left you last week, that causing all kinds of kerfluffles all week with rather... You know, really didn't do them any favors, really didn't go far enough, really didn't deal with the bigger issues here. Listen, they messed up on that one story. And by the way, messing up on that one story meant that they never got to the essence of the story about Bush and the National Guard. That got lost, right?
Yeah.
And so it all became about Dan Rather. It all became about that. And the problem is not so much bias as it is hubris. It's that these guys... think that they can do no wrong. And of course they can. They're human. We're all human. We've got to bring media back down to the level. I actually suggested this week on my blog that Viacom should just sell CBS News.
Yeah.
It's fun. How about the Democratic National Committee?
That'll solve the problem.
Yeah.
Just make it a full-on propaganda outlet.
I think so, right.
Yeah.
Or CNN. You know, Fox, I think, runs on Sirius, runs both the right and left channels. What the heck? Let them do it. They do a good job on the right and have them do the left. You know, there's a need, Andrew Hayward said, or Les Moonves said, for a big cultural change at CBS, but they're not going to get there this way.
Right.
And that's the real problem here, is that it's just more of the same, more of the same, more of the same. Meanwhile, you know, media is changing in big ways, and CBS isn't.
But what is Les Moonves, is like, what is his real goal? I mean, you know, this is a guy, he's an entertainer. He's an entertainment.
Exactly. They should concentrate on entertainment and get rid of the news division. It's shrinking by the day.
Well, what happened to returning integrity and credibility to the news?
Maybe somebody else could. Maybe somebody else could run it, could do that.
But aren't they profit-driven? I mean, in the end, and I think this is a real sea change from when I was growing up, when people really felt that news was part of a public affairs mandate that networks and local stations had.
It's a great point, Mark. But that really isn't where it is now. News is a profit-driven thing. 60 Minutes is incredibly profitable.
Yeah.
It has been for years. You know, drove the network, which is a good thing. Give us good stuff, we will watch it. You know, we're not dumb out here. But this is an entertainment company. It's a gigantic entertainment company. And somebody has to concentrate on the news business in a new way. And I don't think that's necessarily Les Moonves or the fact that Andrew Hayward, the head of CBS, had to wait for a Blue Ribbon Commission to fire people. If they should have been fired, he should have done it months ago, or he shouldn't have done it at all.
So you're saying there needs to be a separation of news and entertainment?
Yeah.
Like what almost like that did you, like network, like the movie
right,
network.
Right.
I mean, this is like now we've come full circle and it needs to be re-separated.
Yeah, I think so.
And then what? They're not supposed to worry about ratings anymore, and the news should be the news.
Well, or let's say CNN runs them. Let's say CNN has a half hour every night on the network. They would just compete with NBC now and try to do good, smart things.
Mm. Yeah. So the thing is interesting is what you're saying is that you're almost saying that CNN, which is a news network, should take an hour in its broadcasting day and say, okay, this is the real news.
Yeah. Yeah.
But well, you know, Jeff, the thing I'm curious about, I mean, we're talking now about, as you very correctly point out, an entertainment-driven situation versus, you know, actually doing news. Was there any, or are there going to be any policy differences in the way CBS gathers news that people will be able to say, this is the result of the report?
Good question. I don't think nearly enough. They appointed as their new conscience a veteran of CBS of, I think, 34 years from the old Tiffany days. Remember those?
Yeah.
And they put on more commissions and more committees, meaning more separation from the journalists to the people they're supposed to serve. They should do the opposite. They should tear down the walls. They should get to the people. They're not doing that. No, I don't think there's enough of a change here. And today's report from Time Magazine and the New York Post is that the new anchor is likely to be Katie Couric.
I heard that, yeah.
You know, and you know, fine, Katie can do a news story, too, but that is a purely entertainment-driven decision, and she's gotten fluffier and fluffier and fluffier on the show.
She has, absolutely.
She really has.
So we can expect to see her on, like, Survivor or something one day soon? Is that?
I think we're going to have the nightly diet, you know.
And some puppy stories.
Yeah.
All stuff that promotes the network. One thing that you mentioned the New York Post. One thing the New York Post does really well is promote Fox programming.
Yes.
Whatever it is.
But you know what they also do well, surprisingly, is they put the parentheses and say, well, we own this and we own that.
Yeah.
They own so much. whereas 60 Minutes got in hot water for not saying, well, we own the publishing company that produces this book that we're promoting right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, but when you say hot water, with who really? Yeah, it's an amazing thing to me that, like, Dan Rather, who hasn't made a statement about this thing, okay, the truth of the matter is that the reason he got excited about this setup, I think he was set up personally, the reason he got excited about it is it actually gave him this opportunity to do what news is supposed to be about, you know, real investigative journalism.
Well, and part of that, to my mind, is that forget the word bias, right? It's a loaded word. Take that word out and ask the question, does Dan Rather have a perspective about George Bush? Well, of course he does.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
He's intelligent and human. And does he like George Bush? I doubt it.
Right.
Does he think that he's a great president? Probably not. What's the harm in him saying that? What's the harm in giving that perspective? That's what people don't trust in him now, because he acts as if he doesn't have that.
But that's supposed to be, isn't it, one of the tenets of journalism?
It was when I was raised in the business, many years ago.
Well, why shouldn't it be now on some level?
Because I think it's a lie of omission, Mark. I think that the truth is, if I say, you can sit here and say you have opinions, you have them every day, right?
Yeah.
If you suddenly got hired by CNN, suddenly zap! You have no opinions. You
right.
become this automaton. The flies have taken you over, right?
Right.
You know, that's not going to happen. You still are an intelligent guy who looks at the world and has opinions.
Yeah, but still, you know, can't you separate that? It's like, you know, here are my opinions. This is my job.
Yes, you can, but I think that you have to give people some perspective, and you can't separate it fully.
Right.
And so, you know, Meigs was going after Bush. Okay.
Right.
Say that. Say, I don't trust the son of a bitch, and I'm going to go get him.
Right.
All right?
Right.
You know, but
right.
now, there's something else that people, I think, are missing out on here. You know, CBS, one of the things that happened in the wake of this whole National Guard thing was the CBS got, again, re-tagged as the liberal network, liberal bias, blah, blah, blah. But wasn't CBS the same network that, at the behest of the White House, withheld a story for a couple, 3 weeks not too long ago?
Which one was that?
There was a story... I believe it was Abu Ghraib, wasn't it?
I think you're right. Yeah, it was Abu Ghraib. Do us a favor.
Don't, you know, publish all this.
Don't break this. Don't cover ourselves.
It's all about power and power, right? The point now is it's about the people, and the people get lost in this. And that's where, you know, I'm going to do my usual blog triumphalism thing, but the fact that there are more voices now about this is a good thing.
Yeah, but also, isn't there some news out that some of the bloggers have been bought out and become propaganda outlets for the bad guys?
Where's my payoff, Mary?
Yeah, we'll be
back. I want my money.
We'll be back in a second. It's 45 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition.
Just to wake you up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yo!
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. We're talking to Jeff Jarvis from BuzzMachine.com, our media guy. So, Armstrong Williams.
Yeah.
Got nailed on being a shill.
Right.
Okay, so now there's some...
But, you know, he was a shill. He owned a PR firm. We ought to establish he was a shill to begin with.
They didn't have to pay him.
No, they didn't.
Right, it was a waste of tax dollars.
But that, the argument is he was a journalist, a commentator.
He was outraged, right. Jill.
So now there has been some stories coming out, Jeff, correct me if I'm wrong, that some bloggers...
There's been a kerfluffle. It was well known these two bloggers were paid by the Dean campaign.
Okay.
But Zephyr Teachout, who was a web guru at the campaign, wrote on her blog, Zonkette, last week, that when they paid the bloggers behind Daily Kos and MyDD... That the she said the campaign's motive was not so much to get their consultation that they were paying for, but to get their voice, to buy them. Now, importantly, let me get this right in here,
okay.
That the hosts put up a disclaimer immediately saying, I'm working for the Dean campaign, so it was known. MyDD, Jerome Armstrong, stopped blogging. You know, the problem was this became a huge, all the Deaniacs, you know, came back together to bitch slap each other this week. But the truth was, the real story wasn't that they got the money, because we knew that already.
Okay.
Right? The real story, the real question is, what was the campaign's motive behind this?
Mm.
Did they have the same motive that the Department of Education had with Armstrong Williams? Were they trying to buy influence? Were they trying to buy buzz? Were they trying to buy citizens? Now, that's a question. Now, in this case, now others are coming back and saying, no, the Zephyr Teachout's full of it and that wasn't happening. Whatever. It still raises an important issue. There are a lot of object lessons here for citizens media in the Armstrong-Williams story and the Dan Rather story. We're going to invent a new medium here. How should we do it?
Okay. Well, so, but, you know, still the truth of the matter is that propaganda, if we're going to call it that, or people who are paid to disseminate information of an ideological bias for a particular power structure is what it is.
Yes. Yeah, it is. It
so,
is. But, you know, I thought about it this weekend and I thought, all right, so blogging looks like media, smells like media, tastes like media. Is it media? Is it news media? Well, not necessarily. Coase said, I'm an activist. I'm not a journalist. Okay, fair, right? You can use the tool to be an activist. However, if people come to a site and say, oh, here's the news, well, they also need to know who pays him and that he feels he's an activist, not a reporter.
Mm-hmm.
This is a new medium. Bob Lutz, the vice chairman of GM, a legendary car design guy from Chrysler, now at GM, started a blog a week ago. Now, you know who's paying him. The GM logo's right there.
Yeah.
It's still valuable to have that. It's still a good perspective, but you know exactly where he's coming from and you know what he's not going to say. Same with these guys who are getting paid by Dean. You now have a financial relationship that goes beyond advertising, and you're in a consulting relationship. You've got to make sure that that is transparent and known.
Now,
go ahead.
Well, now, unlike Armstrong Williams, Dean wants to be chair of the DNC.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that any of these revelations are going to hurt his chances?
Another blogger this week named Chris Nolan said, you know what, darn it, you fools, it's all about politics. Of course it is. And argues that Zephyr Teachout, who's been behind Dean, did this in a timing because the bloggers she outed of sorts, as well as Joe Trippi, have instead endorsed Simon Rosenberg for DNC chair.
Ooh.
So there's a little intrigue here in the old Deniac world.
It's a catty little world you live in.
Yeah, now, Simon Rosenberg, we should let people know, is the Silicon Valley guy.
He's the guy, he's a centrist, the New Democratic Network, am I right?
I think so.
Yeah, well, let's pull it around. So now you're saying that the blog is this big sort of, you know, unregulated, sort of hard to, the only context is the blog itself. So how do you tell what is journalism? How do you tell what is being used as propaganda? Because everyone can just say, hey, I'm just writing my thing. Now, and then you argue on the other side in terms of network news that, you know, they should get rid of it. I mean, where do we find some sort of barometer of integrity?
I don't know that you get rid of network news. But you do have standards of professionalism. You do have real reporters, which also kind of admit we're all human. We're all in this together.
Well, that's clearly what the blog does, but that means it's fallible as an information resource in terms of having integrity.
Ain't they all?
Okay.
Right? It comes down to personal integrity. Quick story. When I started Entertainment Weekly at Time Inc., they were merging with Warner Brothers at the time to become Time Warner. Mm-hmm. Not as bad a mistake as becoming AOL Time Warner. And my damn stock. So I had a conceit of having grades and reviews there. Well, we were being too tough on entertainment, said my bosses. Mm-hmm. They actually, some guy, very high-paid guy, sat down and calculated the grade point average we were given and tried to convince me not to give Fs anymore. For that reason and others, I quit.
Well, they wanted the Jarvis curve.
They did, yeah.
They wanted you to play
be nice.
Certain, be nice. And to their products, I'm sure, be nicer.
Oh, they were a little smarter than that. If you're nice to all, you'll be nice to their products.
Well, that's, yeah. That's how reviewers all are. I mean, it's hard to find a reviewer that isn't some sort of shill for, you know, the power structure, isn't
the
it?
The Critic Anti-Defamation League is coming after you.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. We've got our own spies.
Look, all I know is that a bunch of people, a bunch of critics, you know, self-appointed sycophants who have nothing good to say about anything because they're bitter that they didn't actually do something with their lives, said that I Heart Huckabees was crap. And I went to see it, and there's no way that movie was crap.
I fell asleep. I was the only person. It was crap.
It was crap.
Oh, God, it made no sense.
What drug did you take there?
Who are you?
Wait a minute. This started to sound like the Black Crowes discussion we had on Friday.
What drugs did I take? I mean, I had an open mind to a guy.
Do you have no taste, man?
I do have taste. That guy is a great director.
Yeah, what drugs was he on?
I don't know what drug he was on, but he did something I've never seen. I had a unique movie experience. I walked out of there baffled. It was sort of like watching a UNESCO play. There was elements of absurdism.
But this proves the point. Everybody has perspective. Right?
Okay.
You are tasteless enough to like I Heart Huckabees, and that's fine.
That's
right?
It's not an issue of taste. Maybe you are narrow-minded enough to
admit
it as being not a very good movie.
But that's what makes the world go round. That's why more perspective is good. It's a good thing in media.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I understand what you're saying, but you're wrong about the movie. And
no, you're wrong.
All right.
Baseless, wrong-headed. We got to continue
all
this
right.
next
all right.
week, don't
Jeff
we?
Jeff Jarvis, thank you again for being with us. It's starting to get good with me.
We're getting mad at each other.
Yeah, we'll settle this outside like mad.
I wish I had time to do a blog. Maybe I could get on board with the world that
I'll
you're
get
in.
You there. I'll corrupt you.
Okay. All right. We'll get on it. There's the sound of the fax machine, which gives us our liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. Write these down, folks. Here are your marching orders. One, in order of Martin Luther King Day, have a dream that doesn't involve winning the lottery or a co-worker in her underwear. Two, Inauguration Week, Liberal Feel Good Film Festival, Field of Dreams, The Big Chill, All the President's Men, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, The Grapes of Wrath, The Birdcage, Silkwood, Malcolm X, Fahrenheit 9/11, and maybe some tasteful porn. Three, in response to Colin Powell's claim that our troops would be home from Iraq by the end of the year, at the end of this year, keep saying, are they home yet? Are they home yet? Are they home yet? Are they home yet? Until they finally come home. Four, after last night's performance at the Golden Globes, take Robin Williams off speed dial. He must be stopped. Five, today's phrase, just drop it into conversation. Wow, Grainer gets 10 years for Abu Ghraib? Good to know a world-class sadistic douchebag gets the same sentence as a kid selling nickel bags in the parking lot. Wake up, sheeple. The game is fixed, man.
Lord.
What do we got tomorrow there, Riley?
Tomorrow, we've got a freelance journalist who founded Baghdad Bulletin, Baghdad's first English language newspaper. The elections are coming up. We'll talk to David Enders about that and much more. Have a good one, Mary.
You too, Riley.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.